au quartier des spectacles, Parc La Fontaine et cabaret La Tulipe. Info à itinfolie.com.
This summer, I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are broadcasting 13 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Spoken Word Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have audio from a talk given by Simon Fraser University called X, Psychiatric Solitary Confinement. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, at @avalancheckut.
Le festival Nuit d'Afrique, the rendezvous of world music, invites you to the 36th edition from the 12th to the 24th of July in Montreal. Do not miss one of Brazil's most amazing vocalists, Fabiana Coza, the pillars of Jinawi tradition, Mukhtar Ghania, and Jinawa Soul. The electric blues of the fabulous Don Tyler Watson. Live moments of pure beauty with a South African performance by Derek Gripper and the griot of Corazal Kisisoko. For the full program and tickets, go to festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Welcome back to The Avalanche, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:03. On today's show, audio from a talk given by Simon Fraser University, titled X, Psychiatric Solitary Confinement, and the discussion between Aaron Soros and Harsha Walia. That's up now. A warning for psychiatric hospitalization and solitary confinement. Harsha, do you want to add, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I do.
Hi, I'm keenly listening. Let me just say Thank you again, Aaron, and thank you so much to everyone who read and performed your words. It's incredibly powerful, and I'm sitting with them in so many different ways, but just so much gratitude and respect, and, you know, again, for sharing this work, for allowing us to be part of it, and for witnessing. And yes, please, if people have questions, I know that there was in the chat a question about whether, Aaron, you're taking creative direction questions or creative decision questions. I believe you are. So please feel free, anybody in this conversation, to please post any questions or comments. Aaron and I had a few things that we were going to chat about. So thank you all for listening to us, primarily to Aaron. And please do chime in. As Aaron mentioned, this is very informal. And if I may start, Aaron, you know, one of the things that struck me and that all of you were reading, amongst other things, was the way in which time shows up in your words and, you know, in your imagery and in your phrasing, your calendar now as well, that you showed us, that you and we are so proud of. And so I'm thinking about the ways in which you are asking about time, what happens to time in here. It is indefinite entrapment, the watch, the clock. I'm thoughtful, as Logan mentioned, you know, about not collapsing necessarily, or the ways in which different forms of carceral institutions are the same, because of course we know there are ways in which they are different. But one of the ways in which those similarities, at least in their logics, that strike me as similar, is what Ruth Wilson Gilmore calls the extraction of time, when Ruthie Gilmore says that prison and unfreedom more broadly is the extraction of time. And I'm wondering if you're up for thinking alongside and talking more about the ways in which psychiatric confinement and trauma and, you know, prisons and carceral systems at large are these extractions of time amongst other things in terms of thinking about dispossession and unfreedom.
Gilmore is amazing. And that quote really relates to the sense of the indeterminacy that I wanted to capture in the piece, but also in the psych ward. Like, you're in this, it's kind of, they do this sort of, I actually really like OT people. They're some of the kindest people. They're the least well-paid people in the system, and they're the kindest. So people like the janitors or the OT people are, I had really good conversations with the woman who cleaned my room. And the OT people were really great, but it's kind of like it's the way that the psych system approaches that is that it's kind of like popsicle sticks at summer camp. Like it's just a holding pattern. It's not actually care work. It's not leading towards something. And if you're in the ward enough, the same thing will repeat over and over again. So there's no sort of progress within. There's no therapeutic orientation of movement within your time in the ward. And this experience of solitary, we can critique clock time, and we can critique, you know, the way that we're pummeled into it all the time. But to be completely outside of any orientation to the day or the night. And what's interesting is that Christopher Bolas, a psychoanalyst, he does something which analysts call object-oriented questions. So if he works with somebody experiencing psychosis, he asks very gentle, simple, like somebody can be moving in very associatively intense ways. So just say, oh, was that Thursday? Oh, I see. Oh, and you were where, what part of town? Oh, I've been to that cinema before. And what he does is he's using the way that we have sharing, even if somebody is moving in a very associative, frightening way, to you frightening. So in your subjective experience, it's frightening you. You can find an anchor by asking a simple object-oriented question about where they were and when it was. And that kind of linking to time is not just a linking to value and to our value within time, but also it links us intersubjectively. Because it's one of the ways that if you think about when you're meeting someone, what's the first thing you do? When are we meeting you? When and where am I meeting you? And if you can be with somebody in that state and kind of anchor or stitch them back into time and to place, it's psychologically orienting, but it's also humanizing. It's, we are in this space. Oh, and you can actually say something like, oh yeah, I've been there before. Or, oh yeah, yeah, I'm worried about tomorrow too. I've got a lot going on. Or, oh, that Thursday I was doing this. Like, there's a way of being with each other. And so there's a sense for me in the psych system that your time, especially for people, I can't speak for other disorders, but I have I'm called psychosis not otherwise specified. So it has elements of different psychotic disorders, but it comes on really fast and resolves itself quickly. And it's linked to, in my experience, to trauma. And what happens to me temporally is they don't address any of the trauma. They don't speak to the individual trauma, the family trauma, or the collective trauma. And there's three intersecting, they're all intersecting. And I have only been hospitalized or had psychotic experiences at 3 points on the calendar, only 3 points. So the beginning of November, the beginning of the Easter, around Easter, and August. And I can tell you why on the calendar, but they don't ask me about my personal calendar. They don't put me within my time, my mental signifying system. And they also don't have any, and this is gets to the sense of the extraction. I see the psych system as a kind of holding space, as a storage facility for insane people. And I'm speaking again, this is my experience. I'm in dialogue with other people. Other people can talk about their experience, but I've just witnessed, we're just in there. And it's kind of like we are not valued. Our experience of time is not valued. And then when I get out, when I say, well, the drug is making me sleep 12 hours a day, I'm sleeping 12, and they'll say, oh, well, they actually said to me, well, you are in middle age now, and your energy is gone. And I'm like, I'm talking about a month ago, I was getting up at 7. Like, this is not some sort of slow change in my life. Like, and if I describe that my time is being erased by sleep, but by the side effects, and this is actually documented in the reports that I've been sharing in the link, this is collectively documented, that our side effects that affect our time, that numb us, that make us not able to sleep. And again, I'm not against the use of medication, but I'm interested in speaking with our bodies and our time and seeing it as valuable. And that is we're going to be drugging people very differently if we actually are interested in their minds and interested in what their days produce.
Thank you for that, Erin. Thank you. There is a question here in the chat, and we'll move on to some of those. And I got some more, and please, more and more questions and comments are so welcome. Something that stood out to me here as an occlusion was the forced medication provision when you're warded. The first few times I read this before the performance time, I was struck by the fact that this never appeared. Did you intentionally exclude this element, or did you want to focus on the embodied rhetoric exclusively? Not in scope is an appropriate answer, Lowell, in yeah. Parentheses. There's also a chat under as well, and I direct people to read that. And Erin, if you want to take a minute to check that chat, or if you just want to go ahead and answer.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm seeing this as a collection of essays, so that each essay is a kind of failed attempt. So to be able to communicate psychosis, which in my experience shatters language. Like at the nth degree, I find it quite hard to speak. So there isn't a clear referent. It's hard to follow my text when I'm in that state. Like I can stitch them back. I can personally say, well, this is from that. This has this association. I can pull you back into what the private meaning is, but somebody they're hard to follow. So what I'm working with is that paradox, and working with that each piece is a fragment. And I see them as kind of, it's sort of like a self-portrait or a memoir as a cubist painting. So each piece gives you an angle on something and is incomplete and actually is a failure. So I can say that this piece, I think I elliptically talk about the forced medication when I talk about docility, but I'm not as I said, I've been hospitalized 7 times and I've been in restraints twice. So usually it's a chemical restraint. And in the UK, you can't tie someone up, but they use a chemical restraint. They have people that you have a secure guard sit on you like a suitcase. And like, literally you're like this object under security guards. And as a woman, I've published about this, and this has been shown on multiple documentations that women experience this restraint. And I think anybody would, but they're talking specifically about women because of our often having other violating experiences, non-binary people, non-normative people having a higher proportion of sexual crimes, that this can be re-traumatizing to be captured that way. But the chemical, the drug, and this is a critique of the medication, is that there is therapeutic benefit to medication, but they're often being used to create docility. They're being used in a punitive way. So I've been threatened with medication if I'm uppity or critiquing something or even critiquing that I have extreme sensitivities to food. I have the ability to projectile vomit, which makes me a terror in these places. So if they're giving me food and it's like not agreeing with me, I'm like, here's my review of the psych ward. It's coming at you. Anyway, that's my little side note of terrorism, but my own personal response. But so I will have other pieces that will look more specifically at the drugging. I have one piece that is called, I call this institutionalized rape. And that piece describes when I was giving forced drugs, I was submitting to the pills, because if you don't take the pills, you're held down and injected. And so it ends up being that you have those two options. You're either going to be held on by security guards, and they're not security guards who are trained in any kind of de-escalation. They're just your Joe normal security guard working at the mall is now working in the hospital. And you get those guys, and they're actually not well paid either. The psychiatrist sneeze and they make more than a security guard does in an hour. So the security guards hold you down. So what I was doing was taking the medication, and I would read a statement aloud saying, I call this institutionalized rape. And I said, one day in the future, I will write an essay and publish this essay called, I call this institutionalized rape. And it's going to be about what it means to be taking forced medication. And again, these are all situations where I was saying, I will take this drug and these doses. And I know actually how to modify my own self. So I will gradually slow down and gradually get back to sleep. I don't need to be zombified. It will. So I was not saying no drugs at all. I was saying, I won't take olanzapine. It gives me seizures. They wouldn't let me negotiate. And that document, I have published that, we'll put it in the text, it's called I Call This Institutionalized Rape. And it's been published now 4 times. So I thought of currying a copy of the psych ward. The other thing is that I think with this piece, and this gets to Shane saying, I'm happy that you said that there was a sense of ache in the piece. I feel this is failed piece for 2 reasons. One, on the paradox that you can't in some ways communicate solitary confinement, because I'm connecting to you. I'm speaking. That absolute abject isolation, terror, when you have no grounding point, when you're floundering in your mind and there's nobody to ground, there's no familiar face, there's no clock, there's no tree, there's no window. I don't know if I can communicate that. I think because I have to communicate in language, or I communicate in language, I guess there are other forms. And I think that gives it a containment. I also think I wanted with this piece to have some beauty in it. I wanted to have escape. I wanted to have fantasy. The truth is that the experience of solitary confinement and restraint is so traumatic to me. And we tend to use that sometimes more broadly. I mean trauma that breaks the brain, that cannot be contained by the mind. I actually have blackouts, and I have only had blackouts in relation to this. So I'll know that the straps are coming on, and it's before the medicine hits. I'm completely blacking out the experience. And this is a situation recently where the police brought me to the hospital. I saw a black man walk in front of me. He wasn't a hallucinatory black man. There was something about the police. I was in handcuffs, my own fear as a mad person with police, but also the way that I hold grief and rage for other communities. And the boundary between self and other when you're psychotic isn't always clear. Like, I know that I'm not, that I'm white, that I have that privilege, but I'm holding pain and rage for other communities. From that moment forward, I'm in handcuffs with the police, the man walked in front of me, I blacked out. I have no memory, no recollection of 2 days in the hospital. And then I came to, and I'm in these restraints. And what they had done is when they tied me down, I don't think I'm getting the ache, Shane. I think I could do a lot more with that, because they tied me and this arm fell wrong, and they didn't readjust me. It was like really tight, and it was really awkward. And then at one point I said, and you have these moments, you think, I will look back and think, well, how did I use the bathroom? They told me to pee in the bed. The bed is lined, and I'm not capable of peeing in bed. I actually couldn't figure out how to do that. Like, so I was like, they do release you to use the bathroom, and you're tied up again. But the nurse actually told me to pee in the bed. And so I think I think this is an escape piece. I think I'm trying in this piece to give me some sort of solace. Because if I went truly into the trauma, it would be a kind of absolute abject cracking. And it's an experience of absolute humiliation, like just dehumanizing, humiliating experience. And what was happening to me this would be the only text, is when I was in there, when I came to, I kept saying, please don't do this to me. Please don't do this to me. Please don't do this to me. I kept saying it. There was nobody in the room, but I kept saying it to no one and announcing kind of a subjectivity to the world, but it was an unheard claim. And I knew something was unjust in what was happening to me. And I knew that it should not be happening. And it has no therapeutic value whatsoever. These moments are traumatic. So that's a long answer to that question, but I don't see this as a successful text. I think it's interesting. It can work with other texts, but I'm not sure it's possible. I should say also in the policy, I've written essays, Hersha, that I've shared there on looking at directly at the policy. So some of my work is creative, some of it is more legalistic. And which is interesting is that the policy itself has its own poetry. So the way that the policy is described, even the shorthand, like I was certified, in the UK you're called sectioned, and that refers to the section of the paperwork. The slang term here is pink slip. So that's the paperwork, the color of the paper. So it's a way of taking away agency. So it's sort of like no one is doing this. And it's extraordinarily vague language if you look at the policy. There are no controls. There is no limits to how long you can be put in solitary. There's no limits to how long you can put restraint. There's no description of what tools can be used and what can't be used, who can do it, who can't do it. It's just that we can be subject to discipline. And then the other thing is that it does not have to be that you have threatened anyone or that you're a threat to anyone, nor does the police putting you in handcuffs. There's a very low threshold in British Columbia. It does not have to be proven that you are actually a danger to yourself or other. It just has to be that the police, quote unquote, apprehend that you are someone with a mental health disorder and you are not working appropriately the environment or with others. And there's no question, like the environment is abstract and neutral, and others, abstract and neutral. There's no description that you might be responding to something or that your environment might not be appropriate. And this is, again, where you look at psychotic disorders in terms of people in refugee camps, people who racialize people who are immigrants, not white immigrants to countries, much higher proportion, people who are queer or trans, people who, anytime you have experiences of war, these, if you have a vulnerability, as I have a vulnerability, it can bring that to the fore.
Thank you, Erin. And there's a comment from Amanda in response to what you were describing earlier, that it's a form of torture, right? Like in the ways in which torture is intentional dehumanization and oppression, and really the basic violation of consent, right? And thinking through settler colonialism and so many other forms of oppression and annihilation and genocide and eugenics, it really is to deeply impact, deliberately impact that sense of autonomy, right? To make different communities and struggle feel as if though autonomy is not something that we inherently are entitled to, but something that we must beg for, right? And that we're not entitled to in our day-to-day as a form of self-determination. And so just echoing that comment about how deeply that is as a form of torture.
It goes against the charter. Yeah. It goes against the UN Convention of rights for people with disabilities. It goes against legal protections we have. And also, I think, Hersha, you know this in terms of deemed consent in BC. It's the only province where, as a psych patient, I am deemed to consent to my treatment. Even if, as you can see on my calendar, I know that I'm going to a fairly advanced psychoanalytic class on Thursday. I can figure this out, but I still can't figure out, they think, any aspect of my treatment. So I was deemed to consent to involuntary treatment for a month after I made this calendar. And in fact, this calendar was read as like, this woman said to me that I shouldn't, that's the problem, you're working too hard. And it had not been that I had been working too hard. And she had no sense that this was an orientation to the world and that this communicated my subjectivity in this time when it wasn't being seen. And I think of this in terms of torture as the physical torture. I have nightmares ever since 2007, the first time this happened, I've had nightmares. Just as I'm about to fall asleep, I get this sort of sense of, am I tied? Am I tied? Am I tied? I don't know when they're going away. So to be going back in that space and to know that it was going to happen again, it's a physical terror. it also has this feeling where you have a sense of an I-it relation. There is no sense of, I could say this, well, this drug troubles me, or can you, or what I might need, or what food might soothe me. There isn't, you can feel it. As I said, I had the janitor was lovely to me. The janitor, I heard she was listening to music on the radio. This is when I was in the ward and not in solitary. And we had like a conversation, a 10-minute conversation about the music she was listening to. And I could feel I-Val. I could feel that she was speaking to me as a person. And that was remarkable because I was not an I-it in that situation. So it's a torture. And this gets back to Logan's point, is that the physical and the psychic are bound in the carceral situation. And you also internalize it. I could even hear myself internalizing, wanting to get approval, wanting to be like, you get these little leaves. You get 1 hour leave, and for a few days you get an hour leave. You have to. The other thing they took away for 2 weeks, they took away my clothing privileges. So I was not allowed my own clothing. I was on the phone with friends going, yeah, I didn't know this, but clothing is a privilege. Like I actually made it kind of fun because I told the nurses that they had to get me clothes out of the, I was in pajamas all day. So I said, I will wear shades of blue and nothing warm tones and no beige. So I was like setting my order. So I did try, and we really struggle for our own agency in the psych ward. Anybody who's been in a psych ward know that community, intimacy, care, agency, humor, wit, like the ways that we make fun of people, the ways that we sneak each other moisturizer, the way that we, there was like one guy had somehow got pot in the ward, and I ran and got my hair product. I hadn't sprayed it on him to get like some smell so that he could, like, we were just, the way that we were, it was kind of a really happy chaos in these tiny little moments of resistance in the ward. And anybody who's been in a ward knows of those.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Erin. I mean, thank you is a weird word. So please understand the spirit with which that word is, that phrase is intended in this context. Amanda and Jane, if you don't mind just dropping a quick note or thumbs up to me, if I can read out your comments. I know they're shared with everyone, but I know this is also being broadcast. And I know, Erin, that you wanted to, you've mentioned in the conversation, in the context of our conversation already, and I know that you have been involved in and wanted to share a bit more about what's been going on specifically in so-called British Columbia and this province on unceded, unsurrendered, stolen lands around some of the legal challenges. And you've mentioned around how the laws in BC are so broad around deemed consent. And Jane, as you say, the verb deem is so deceptive and authoritarian. It's like a verb that someone wedges into someone else. And Amanda, you say that the law is so broad in BC that it can be used for retaliation, control, and abuse. So Erin, did you want to share a bit more about some of the legal challenges that you're aware of and that are ongoing? A case just recently came down from the Supreme Court of Canada allowing a number of organizations to proceed with a constitutional challenge in BC to BC's Mental Health Act and so much more. So if you wanted to talk a little bit more about that.
I spent the whole week riding around Vancouver on my bicycle, re-listening to Border and Rule to prepare for this interview. So I don't know, we're not going to talk about that, but I've been doing my homework. And I also reread all the documents on the challenges and what it's the organizations representing people with disabilities. Hersha, you're doing a better job of it that in terms of policy than I am, but that it's been 5 years the government has fought their ability to challenge the legality of the Mental Health Act. The Mental Health Act, the Supreme Court has now overruled the government's fighting. And so that this is being challenged under the Charter and under the United Nations Convention of for People of Disabilities, that it is negating our rights to, I think there is, so, I mean, there was, the report was 180 pages long that I was just reading. I've included a couple of them in the chat. And what was interesting in the report is that I'm a narrative person, so I was reading the aspects of the law, and what they're asking for is limitations, expressed description of limitation. There's no limitation on how long you can be in solitary or how long you can be restrained. There's no overseeing. There's no requirement of a checks and balances. So you can fight for, you can go to a board yourself. You have to put that forward when you're in the psych ward. It's very hard. You're not really encouraged to do that. In fact, you're actively discouraged to do that. And so what they're saying in the challenge is to have that as part of the program. And then the other thing is that in the community, in the UK, it's called a community treatment order. I'm forgetting the legal term here in BC, but it's that when you're in the community, but you can still be constrained within the Mental Health Act, and your treatment is still determined, and so you still are not a free person. That is indefinite. There are no checks and balances, and people go a long time without even being read or without even meeting with a psychiatrist. So they'll just be dealing with social workers who have no power to change that community treatment order. I'm using that language because I was threatened with that in the UK, and that would be involuntary injections every 2 weeks indefinitely. And the only reason I got away from it is that I have Canadian citizenship and I left the country. That's how I got out of it. And I actually know that this is stating in the document that in BC, people leave BC to get mental health care elsewhere because this deemed consent was only operative in BC. And what it does is negate my role in choosing medication. I also cannot say I want a man to represent me when I'm struggling, or I want my parents to represent me when I'm struggling. I can't assign someone. Anyone else can do that. If you have another medical condition that sometimes makes you incapable of making decisions, you can assign someone for you. I can't assign anyone. I am always available to the psych system in this way. And the law doesn't go into the police apprehension, but that's one of the things I want to challenge as well, is that the way that the police is operating in tandem with the psych ward. So that you get these 1 hour leaves. If you don't, then you bill up to 2 hours leaves and then 3 hours leave, and you have to be on good behavior. They will take the leave away if you are not in good behavior. And people try to escape. So in November, I was in the psych ward and one of the guys tried to escape. He actually went into the mountains I think he was tracked down. Somebody, he phoned someone, he got tracked. The police brought him back and he got back and he was put in solitary as a kind of a stopgap. And I think that was punitive. I don't think he needed to be in solitary. When we're talking, one of the things I would like politically is for when we're speaking about police and prisons and borders, for all us also to look at carceral psychiatry. And again, I'm not against, I'm taking classes in psychoanalysis. I'm interested in mental health care with the word emphasis on care. But that would be things like consensual treatment, peer-led treatment, alternative forms of care. The most requested form of care in the hospital is talk therapy. That people are asking for someone to talk to, and that isn't available. So when I got out of the hospital in November, people think there's a thing called the mental health crisis. There is no such thing as a crisis that is independent from the things that led up to it. And we're never looking at the fact that we are not offering care. We are not offering safe housing to go. If I had in that week, my friends all knew I was symptomatic. In that week, if I knew there was a non-carceral house where I could go and people would just, I would start taking the upping the dose of the medication slowly. My meals would be taken care of. I could relax. I would have gone there. I would have walked there. But then it's not offered. It's a flow chart with only the carceral as a response. It's the only response. So I'm interested in the law because I want to see what challenges are happening. But I'm also interested in what Ruth Gilmore speaks about abolition as presencing. And I think when people will say, what else could they have done? And I think we're given this flow chart where things like prisons and things like borders, they become inevitable. We think that we can't think around them. And that's where I think poetry and people who create kind of other visions of possibilities of community, as this one is, that can help nudge us to think about what are the other possibilities. And they can happen early. So you can have talk therapy, other forms of therapy, consensual homes. There's programs internationally and in Canada. There's one in Quebec City where the home is just come and go. And it works. And psychiatry has tried to stop the 388 program in Quebec City. There's also programs like the Parachute program in New York. They lost their funding. They used to be a care program where they went to the community. So starting programs of care. And then even in the crisis, thinking about madness as intersubjective. So when you see someone aberrant, they're aberrant to you. You might not have a way of reading them. Other people in their life might. And they're also acting in the way they are in relation. Speech is intersubjective. So when the police show up at my doorstep, I'm going to be symptomatic. I have enough stories of loved ones in my head, and I have enough experience of myself being assaulted, and you've seen police handcuff you when they throw you to the ground. I have that in my body. I'm going to be symptomatic in some way when the police show up at the door. That's going to happen. But it's not read as intersubjective. It's read as evidence of my illness. And so what I'm thinking about is like forms of care and then forms of coaching for general people. We know how to talk to a toddler. My dad knew how to talk to my brother when he had a night terrors. We have some sense of how to be aberrant speech patterns in other situations, you know, but there's something, and this is the poetics, the media, the representations of madness are always often with a dangerous person, with a point of where the story ends. You meet them after they're off script, they're in the hospital, they're gone. It's not intersubjective. And we're often seen as threat. We're narrated as the threat. And that actually is not statistically accurate.
Erin, I appreciate your call and your reminder to us about the ways in which the antithesis of carcerality is fundamentally care and presence, right? That we build these alternatives, that we have to create them. And it's so important right now because in so many conversations around abolition and defund, it can become too easy to default to the mental health system, right? The way in which the system is currently operating as the antithesis of care, as somehow the solution to the police, even though it is actually a seamless pipeline, right? And they are the same kind of system in terms of their punitive, punishment-based, and you know, really anti-consensual-based systems. And so the reminder to always think alongside prisons and borders and police and carceral institutions and carceral confinement as a continuum, rather than the mental health system as somehow the alternative to policing, right? That's not actually the current system.
We need social workers, not police. And I'm like, social workers, like some of my favorite people are social workers. And the social worker on the ward, Shane, was a star. But they're working within systems, mm-hmm. and they can call the police. So if you have a care team that is auxiliary to the police, that is working in tandem with the police, you've just expanded police powers. You've just expanded it relationally. So we need to be talking about, and complicity is a complex topic because you can be in a system trying to change it, but I think you need to name your complicities and you need to name the limit of your powers. Mm. And I want to know, how are you working against it? Are you naming it? Are you seeing it as the best that we can do or necessary? And without asking for other forms of care. And I was thinking, there was a comment, I think it was Kes, about coaching, that I would like people, I love the informality of this group, even that informality, like we were with each other, we were okay with, like, if there's gonna be pauses, we stayed with the pause, the next person went, it worked. We didn't rehearse this. Like, we talk about rehearsals for a living, we didn't have a rehearsal. We just showed up and we made it work. And what was interesting to me is, I had years ago, the only time I was in a hospital without it being involuntary was when I was at a party with theater students when I had psychotic symptoms. And I tripped up. I have a fixed delusion that I'm at delusions is that I'm at a wedding and we're all at a wedding and I was at a party and I started thinking the books were all giving me messages and I was really like as bad as I get. But they thought I was on drugs. So they weren't scared of me in the normal way. They just thought, oh, Aaron's having a bad trip. And they were really kind and incredible. And they were creative and theater students. So we went into a quiet room of the party. The party continued. No, there was no threat from me. And they said, Aaron, was going about this wedding. They said, well, who would be there in the wedding? And the wedding for me symbolizes community. It symbolizes having people I love from other countries all together. It's not actually the sort of white bride thing. It's the sense of having a collective. And I said, well, my mom would be there. And my friend held my hand and said, what would your mom do? And she said, she'd be looking at me. She'd be letting me know I'm here. And she said, who else would be there? And I said, my dad would be there. And then somebody else held my hand and said, well, if I was your dad, they didn't enter the delusion, but they said, if I was your dad, what would your dad do? And I said, he would get me something to eat. And they said, have you eaten yet today? And I said, well, not since the morning. And so they were able to kind of hover on the edge of something. This was spontaneous and it was the only time I was hospitalized without it being a form of state abduction. And it was through this spontaneous, like, can I find something to connect with you here? Can I ask? And I've done that. And the other thing is about people, you know this, Persia, anybody who's done community work, you work with people in various states of mind. You're not armed. The people working in the downtown east side are not armed. They're not responding with bullets or handcuffs or cuffs to a bed or any kind of physical assault every single time somebody's speech is aberrant. I was in the downtown east side in my 20s, and if somebody talked to me like I was their sister, I would say, oh, interesting. What was your sister like? I wouldn't necessarily jump in their face and say, that's a delusion, I'm not your sister. I would hold that they were long, I would see they were longing for their sister. Can I hold that longing if not the reality? And Kes was talking about medical doctors. If medical doctors who have very little training, as psychiatrists also have very little training, they have a lot of training about the drugs, they don't have therapeutic training. But if there was more training in terms of that ratcheting down your fear and that you can find an element to stitch, that there can be a response, that we don't have to go rushing to the end point of force.
Thank you for that, Erin. And there's a comment by Chantel to call it state abduction is exactly what it is. We have two questions. I'm gonna pose them to you together out of respect for people's time. And Erin, if you're okay to answer them together, I'll repeat them if needed. They're also in the Q&A if you need to look at them again. One is, part of the power of your piece comes from elements of human personality, imagination, wordplay, dramatic shape, and resolution. What a perfect description, Phil, that one does not associate with the dehumanizing power of restraint. The piece is aesthetically interesting as multivocal art. Does a tension between the artistic element of the play and the depersonalizing force of the experiment strike you? And the second one is, what always hits me in your experiences, Erin, is how the people you encounter who push you into carceral care or those within the psych ward often don't understand what you're saying, not because you are saying things that are associative or wrong, but because you are talking about your work and your academic readings or engagements. That because those people don't understand those things, they deem them insane, which says a lot about the nature of what is deemed psychosis and how that is determined. You have so much to say on the subject. I'd love to hear you share it here.
Phil, yeah, it's fascinating in terms of the, I think there is that sort of brute crossing, that the brute or stark crossing, that there is the brute abject sensation of being tied, and I think that the language is a kind of resistance to it. And I think I'm not singular in that. As I said, I've been in hospitals multiple times, and what I hear is beautiful language. I hear people playing in language. I hear us talking about our religious traditions in really fascinating ways, in the way that you would hope a religion would be. So you have people who are Hindu speaking to somebody who is Muslim, who's speaking to somebody who is Jewish, and we're talking about what we find helpful in old traditions. Like there is incredible wisdom in these spaces. And so it's not, I don't think I'm often narrated as the exception, as sort of like, well, we, my whiteness, my education gets me this sort of ticket out. And I want to hold that those moments of poetry are existing in the ward. Anybody who reads poetry, and when you sit in a psych ward, you will hear poetry. It's disorganized poetry, but so is poetry in its first draft. You know, it doesn't look like the thing you read on the page. If we will work with T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, we will work with James Joyce's Ulysses. We will work with these texts that push us on language. We're curious about them. And then when we encounter someone who doesn't have the education, we're not engaged with that language. So that sort of richness, I witnessed a lot of that. The other question, sorry, I was just blanking on it. Can you refer for Shashmi? They were kind of connected.
Yes, I'll read it again. The other one was, does a tension between the artistic element of the play and the depersonalizing force of the experiment strike you?
Oh, that was I answered, but the second-
Yeah, and then the second one was whether, if you could speak more about, I can just read the whole one because it's, I don't want to cut it off. The people you encounter who push you into carceral care or those within the psych ward often don't understand what you're saying, not because you are saying things that are associative or wrong, but because you are talking about your work and your academic readings or engagements. They were very similar questions. Because those people don't understand those things, they deem them insane, which says a lot about the nature of what is deemed psychosis and how that is determined. You have so much to say on the subject. I'd love to hear you share it here.
Yeah, I think this is a case for everyone, but I think what my experience is that my aperture gets too wide and I don't know how to self-edit. So AL, there's too many words. But also I'm not like, I'll speak, I have all these, like my normal day would be like talk to a Black studies abolitionist and then talk to a Lacanian psychoanalyst and then go to the grocery store and then talk to somebody else about poetry. And the communities don't really, in my mind, they're all mixed up, but those dialogues, the different references, different communities, when I'm not well, they all mish together. But I'm actually saying things like, I remember that I was saying, I said, oh my God, I'm in the real. This is the experience of the real. This makes no sense to psychiatrists. I was talking with Lacanian psychoanalysts and I was actually right. Or I'll talk about Laplanche and afterwardness, which is where trauma, you don't encounter it in some way, that it enters your psyche without representation. And so that it emerges later. I'm actually using my PhD to narrate what is happening, but there isn't that connection. And I can give you a banal example of, I use this in the other talk, that I was talking about December 6th and I would get corrected. I have a fear of male violence and specifically of male violence at this kind of event where I have been stalked individually and I have a great fear of other people being hurt at an event like this through, you know, I've lived in the States. So it's not an irrational fear where if somebody who's following me and not just following me, sending me emails for years, gets to one of these events. It's a fear. I get hypervigilant, but it's not actually a paranoid fear. I have paranoid responses to it, but the fear itself is real. And when I say to doctors, December 6th, they'll correct me in the UK. They'll say, it's not December 6th, it's March. They're not hearing a referent. They're not hearing what that code word means. And that, for me, that code word is both presencing and absencing, because it does not signal missing and murdered women. It does not single the women in the downtown east side. They don't get a national date. There was no date. I mean, there is the February 14th, but that's local communities. That's not a news announcer naming somebody's potential in their life. And so there's these, and I also know from people in the psych ward who from the Congo, Rwanda, indigenous people, they are bringing up their collective experiences, but there isn't any holding for that. There is no connection with what some of the comments, because I teach human rights and literature, I would actually get certain things. I would be able to stitch back to people. Or one person, she spoke several African languages and French and English was like her fifth language. And they only spoke to her in English. So we switched to French. And so like there were so many moments where if somebody had just held one seemingly strange piece of language and ask me, what does this mean to you? You know, just that slow, I'm not following this. What does this mean to you? Or even ask me, why do you not want to take this medication? Why do you want to take this one? Like just an attention, a slowing down, a care with that somebody has a unique brain, that they're sitting here in front of you, that there's a human encounter in that moment, that isn't happening. And what we are doing is caring for each other. Patients are listening to each other. Patients are exchanging, you know, lotions and snuck cigarettes and all these forms of care. We're doing it with each other.
Thank you, Erin. You're reminding me of Alicia Elliott when she says, you know, and you're thinking through and you're talking of stitching back and stitching alongside of Alicia Elliott, Tuscarora writer. Who said and wrote in A Mind Spread Across the Ground. I hope I'm getting the title right.
A Mind Spread on the Ground.
A Mind Spread on the Ground about how colonialism and depression both stole my language. And I'm thinking of her and her writing. Wow. And as I listen to you and the ways in which your works speak to each other in so many different ways. I know that people are starting to leave and that we are at 6:04. I just want to turn it to you, Erin, to say your goodbyes. But before I do that, I just want to thank you, Erin, for sharing with us, for spending your hour with us, and for all of the readers and performers for bringing your words into this room, into the world. It's gonna travel with us for so much longer. And just really for allowing us to be alongside and to witness and to share in the ways in which you have. Thank you all so much. Thank you to you, Erin, and for everyone who's involved in bringing this labor of love and care and generosity. And Erin, I'm going to turn it over to you to say goodbye to all of us and to let us know what's coming next and where we can find more of your work.
Thank you so much. I'm I'm so rarely speechless, and I'm actually just, I've reached the limit of my words. I'm really moved by everybody. It was hard to prepare for this. It brought up a lot. I had a kind of fight or flight response. And to think of the kindness in your response to just, yeah, every tiny little text, every DM, every email, it just was a way of stitching me back into the world. And so this was just an incredible experience. I'm so grateful. My neighbor just walked by and he was a witness. He came out and stood when the police got me. And I remember seeing him afterwards and I was ashamed. I thought, because of the criminalization, I said to him, I wanted him to know I'd done nothing wrong. And him, he had just stood staring. And I wanted to bring this in relation to this group of the power of witnessing. He was standing there watching. He didn't intersect with the police, but he was watching what they were doing. And then I spoke to his wife and she says, no, you don't need to explain. She said, we're Persian. We know the police can do awful things, terrible, terrible things. And so just that sense of, in that moment, to see that witness and to think of you guys as a witness and what it means for us, for myself to act as a witness to others' experiences of oppression, and for you to have done this for me. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I may echo, there are so many comments of care and love here, but Erin, you are an absolute gem. Thank you so much. Thank you, all of you. Have a wonderful night until we see each other again.
My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. Quebec has entered the seventh wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Public Health Director Luc Boileau. In the last month, the province saw a 50% increase in COVID-related hospitalizations, up now to 1,500. This would be the first wave Quebec has experienced after removing almost all public health restrictions. And nearly 500 low-rent housing units across Montreal are empty because they are currently undergoing renovations. This is in the midst of a housing crisis that, as of July 2nd, left 118 households in the city without a home. And the North American Irish Dance Championships took place in Montreal last week at the Palais des Congrès. The event attracted nearly 4,000 competitors who were trying to qualify for the World Championships. And the Montreal International Jazz Festival closed on Saturday night. For over a week, the festival featured new and established talent in more than 350 concerts. Two-thirds of these were free. The festival's closing act was an outdoor performance by The Roots, with tens of thousands of audience members packed into Place des Festivals. And now for some news you can use. Indigenous Fridays are back at Cabot Square. These events explore Indigenous art and culture and raise awareness on homelessness in Montreal's Indigenous communities. That's every Friday until August 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. You can find out more on the Cabot Square Project Facebook page. And the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute is having a webinar in support of McGill students in solidarity with Palestine. They'll have Pink Floyd's guitarist, Roger Waters, as a special guest speaker. The webinar is on Thursday at 3 p.m. You can find out more about the event at the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute's Facebook page. And the community group Solidarity Across Borders is organizing a march in support of non-status migrants in Montreal and across Canada. The demonstrators will be meeting at Place Émile de Gamelin on Sunday, July 17th at 2 p.m. You can find out more on the Instagram page ssf.sab or on the website solidarityacrossborders.org. And the nonprofit blood collection agency AIMA Québec wants more Black people to donate blood. Most of the Quebecers with sickle cell anemia and who need regular blood transfusions are Black. It is less risky for regular blood recipients if their donors are more genetically similar. For more information on how to donate, visit hema/quebec.qc.ca.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. There is this thing going on. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to a talk by Simon Fraser University featuring Aaron Soros and Harsha Walia, titled X, Psychiatric Solitary Confinement. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, you can check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at @AvalancheCKUT or CKUT's spoken word department at 514-448-4041 extension 2593 or email spokenword@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter @AvalancheCKUT. Stay tuned for Hersey. That's up next.
Gaila Kasla, my name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Window, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadi, Nwendin Naganag. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you, so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here, and we're very learned people, we're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, you know, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays, and that's just us as this, and I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tanse, how? Wuju anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you I'd like to say Ninanaskamon Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Ninanaskamotaman Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski. Hi, hi. Thank you.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School.
Schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind.